Chapter 8. On reaching home, he talked about Durham until the fact that he had a friend penetrated into the minds of his family. Ada wondered whether it was brother to a certain Miss Durham, not but what she was an only child, while Mrs. Hall confused it with a don named Cumberland. Morris was deeply wounded. One strong feeling arouses another, and a profound irritation against his womenkind set in. His relations with them hitherto had been trivial but stable, but it seemed iniquitous that anyone should mispronounce the name of the man who was more to him than all the world. Home emasculated everything. It was the same with his atheism. No one felt as deeply as he expected. With the crudity of youth, he drew his mother apart and said that he should always respect her religious prejudices and those of the girls, but that his own conscience permitted him to attend church no longer. She said it was a great misfortune.
"I knew you'd be upset. I cannot help it, mother dearest. I am made that way, and it is no good arguing."
"Your poor father always went to church."
"I'm not my father."
Morrie, what a thing to say."
"Well, he isn't," said Kitty, in her perky way.
"Really, mother, come."
"Kitty, dear, you here,"
cried Mrs. Hall, feeling that disapproval was due and unwilling to bestow it on her son.
"We were talking about things not suited, and you are perfectly wrong besides, for Morris is the image of his father. Dr. Barry said so."
"Well, Dr. Barry doesn't go to church himself," said Morris, falling into the family habit of talking all over the shop.
"He is a most clever man," said Mrs. Hall, with finality. "And Mrs. Barry's the same."
This slip of their mother's convulsed Ada and Kitty. They would not stop laughing at the idea of Mrs. Barry's being a man. And Morris's atheism was forgotten. He did not communicate on Easter Sunday, and supposed the row would come then, as in Durham's case, but no one took any notice. For the suburbs no longer exact Christianity. This disgusted him. It made him look at society with new eyes. Did society, while professing to be so moral and sensitive, really mind anything? He wrote often to Durham, long letters trying carefully to express shades of feeling. Durham made little of them and said so. His replies were equally long. Morris never let them out of his pocket, changing them from suit to suit, and even pinning them in his pajamas when he went to bed. He would wake up and touch them, and watching the reflections from the street lamp, remember how he used to feel afraid as a little boy. Episode of Gladys Olcott. Miss Olcott was one of their infrequent guests. She had been good to Mrs. Hall and Ada in some hydro, and, receiving an invitation, had followed it up. She was charming, at least the women said so, and male callers told the son of the house he was a lucky dog. He laughed, they laughed, and having ignored her at first, he took to paying her attentions. Now Morris, though he did not know it, had become an attractive young man. Much exercise had tamed his clumsiness. He was heavy but alert, and his face seemed following the example of his body. Mrs. Hall put it down to his moustache.
"Morris's moustache will be the making of him,"
a remark more profound than she realized. Certainly the little black line of it did pull his face together and show up his teeth when he smiled, and his clothes suited him also. By Durham's advice, he kept to flannel trousers, even on Sunday. He turned his smile on Miss Olcott. It seemed the proper thing to do. She responded. He put his muscles at her service by taking her out in his new sidecar. He sprawled at her feet. Finding she smoked, he persuaded her to stop behind with him in the dining room and to look between his eyes. Blue vapor quivered and shredded and built dissolving walls, and Morris's thoughts voyaged with it, to vanish as soon as a window was opened for fresh air. He saw that she was pleased, and his family, servants and all, intrigued. He determined to go further. Something went wrong at once. Morris paid her compliments, said that her hair, etc., was ripping. She tried to stop him, but he was insensitive and did not know that he had annoyed her. He had read that girls always pretended to stop men who complimented them. He haunted her. When she excused herself from riding with him on the last day, he played the domineering male. She was his guest, she came, and having taken her to some scenery that he considered romantic, he pressed her little hand between his own. It was not that Miss Olcott objected to having her hand pressed. Others had done it, and Morris could have done it had he guessed how, but she knew something was wrong. His touch revolted her. It was a corpse's.
Springing up, she cried, "Mr. Hall, don't be silly. I mean, don't be silly. I'm not saying it to make you sillier."
"Miss Alcott, Gladys, I'd rather die than offend," growled the boy, trying to keep it up.
"I must go back by train," she said, crying a little. "I must. I'm awfully sorry."
She arrived home before him with a sensible little story about a headache and dust in her eyes, but his family also knew that something had gone wrong. Except for this episode, the vac passed pleasantly. Morris did some reading, following his friend's advice rather than his tutor's, and he asserted in one or two ways his belief that he was grown up. At his instigation, his mother dismissed the Howells, who had long paralysed the outdoor department, and set up a motor car instead of a carriage. Everyone was impressed, including the Howells. He also called upon his father's old partner. He had inherited some business aptitude and some money, and it was settled that when he left Cambridge, he should enter the firm as an unauthorised clerk. Hill and Hall, stockbrokers. Morris was stepping into the niche that England had prepared for him.